listening to Sam in the Morning, only on LA Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome back to the show. Today is Wednesday, November 13th, 10 o'clock a.m. from Los Angeles. This is where you are. This is where we are. And we have a very special guest in the studio. But before that, I see in the news here that Trump was just visiting the White House and meeting with Biden and stuff. So that's pretty weird to see them both shaking their hands in the video here. But okay, whatever, you know. Today we're joined by director Adam Graves. Welcome to the show, Adam.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Sam.
Of course. And you've made a very good short film. I don't know how many you've made, but we're going to find out about it from you and everything. And we'll get to the movie, of course. I see you qualified to be considered for the Oscars in 2025.
Yeah, we were very honored to have been awarded the prize for best live action short at the Holly Shorts Film Festival.
Here in Hollywood. And how many movies do you compete with to get to that point?
Well, you know, I guess I was told that Holly Shorts received over 6,000 submissions.
Really?
This year.
So, wow.
I can't remember exactly how many were in the festival, but I think I think close to 200 or over 200. Don't quote me on that number.
Yeah, yeah.
Great festival, by the way, for those of you who haven't, you know, those out there who haven't attended it. It takes place right there at the Chinese Theater in Hollywood. And so about 200 and some films, I think. And then I don't know what percentage of those are live action, probably roughly half.
Okay.
So, or probably a little more than half, I'm guessing.
See. What's the others are what, animation or something?
Yeah, the categories are generally animation, documentary, and live action.
I see. Okay.
And some film festivals do music videos and kinds of things too. But Holly Short specializes, you know, it's a short film festival, I think the best short film festival in the country.
Really?
And they do a really great job and have great curation. But their categories are live action, which is basically narrative and documentary and animation.
So. Right. Have you been to other festivals too before that?
Yeah. We've been to, I had been to some other festivals with a previous short film. And then this film, Anuja, played at a variety of other festivals. We were at Indie Shorts in Indianapolis, which is another great short film festival. At Oscar, also Oscar qualifying festival.
Wow.
And Dead Center was where we premiered. But we've been all over the place. We played at Newport Beach last week, or I should say a couple weeks ago now.
Uh-huh.
Time flies when you're having fun.
So. Yeah, for sure. Well, that's cool. I mean, I'm glad for you. And we'll talk about Anuja quite a little bit. But let's find out a little bit about you. Where were you born and raised?
I'm not sure how interesting this is going to be.
It'll be very interesting, trust me.
Okay, good deal. Okay, we're going to go in depth. I realize we got some time.
Yeah, we got some time.
I was born in St. Cloud, Minnesota, Stearns County. Made famous by the Prairie Home Companion. I guess St. Cloud is probably the closest real town to the fictional town of Lake Wobegon.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if you're familiar with Garrison Keillor.
I remember that book, like in the 70s, was like the biggest thing, but I didn't know anything about it.
Yeah.
But so Lake Wobegon is over there?
It's a fictional, Lake Wobegon is a fictional place in the middle of Minnesota. That Garrison Keillor had dreamt up. Interestingly, Minnesota is kind of famous or known for its Scandinavian roots. A lot of the Sven and Oli kind of crowd, and that's the world that the kind of Lutheran kind of Scandinavian, and that's the world that Garrison Keillor paints. Interestingly, the area that I'm from, ironically, is actually a very German Catholic area, Stearns County, and so my grandmother grew up speaking only German and grew up on a farm in rural country.
Wow.
In rural parts of Minnesota.
So she was born in Germany?
She was born in the States. That's what's interesting.
Oh, really? Did she learn English?
No, even her parents were born in the States. So she was, you know, second, third generation American. But they grew up in a very isolated German community
English at home.
They spoke German at home and English. My grandmother learned English when she was in middle school and started to interact with people outside of her little community.
Yeah.
And then, of course, my parents were born in the early 50s. And so By then, that was after the Second World War. There was a kind of stigma against speaking German. So my grandmother barely taught my mom any German because it was important for them to learn English.
Yeah,
was how they what they were felt you know what they were kind of told. So,
So
unfortunately, I didn't really grow up speaking any myself. But when I go to family reunions, I still have great uncles and stuff, and some aunts and things who speak German.
Yeah, that's amazing because usually kids grow up speaking the language they hear at home. You know. But this was not the case here. I mean, here she spoke German, and whereas they spoke English at home, right?
No. They spoke German at home.
Oh, they did speak.
Yeah, they did speak German at home. Yeah. That's exactly. Yep, they did. They spoke German at home, and their community. You know, it's a small little rural farming community, and I think just everyone in that community pretty much spoke German.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until she left home that she really, you know, I mean. Was sent off to the kind of public school that she started to have to, you know, study English and then learned English.
So. Right. Interesting. Do you have any siblings?
Yeah, I have two brothers, an older brother who's based in Minneapolis.
Uh-huh.
And he's in kind of the hospitality industry and he's into design and all kinds of things like that. Lives a really interesting life. And then my younger brother, he's a real estate agent and classical music composer in New York who actually is a producer on the film.
So you're all creative, a creative family.
I mean, my parents were actually folk singers. I don't know.
Really?
When I was born, that's what they were. My dad was teaching elementary school, but they were, according to them, they were making more money folk singing in the local bars and restaurants around in central Minnesota. And so they had a little, you know, I don't know what you'd call it. They were a duo, Jim and Julie. And they would go around and play folk music. Yeah, so yeah, my mom played the tambourine, my dad played the guitar, and they sang. And
it's amazing they made more money singing than teaching.
You know? Well, that tells you something about the state of education in our society.
Yeah, there you go. I know. My son just started teaching, and you know, he joined a high school, and they pretty much just threw him in the water, and they said teach. You know. And this is those were classes that didn't have a teacher for like a few months.
Wow.
You know, and he's a chemistry he became a chemistry teacher.
Hmm.
You know, so I guess that's what he wanted to do. He did biochemistry in college, and I just can't believe how they didn't give him any instructions, nothing. It's just like go ahead and teach, and and he says 3/4 of the class don't even speak English.
Like
and so try to teach them chemistry with all these concepts and everything, you know.
Wow.
It's like an impossible mission.
That's very
and so I don't know how he managed to get himself in there, but he's doing pretty well now. He's been there a couple months and he's doing well, you know. So I didn't think he would last this long.
Yeah.
I would have.
that is a challenge. My day job is I'm a professor of philosophy.
Really?
And so I spent a lot of time, basically my entire adult life, teaching.
Wow, that's interesting.
At the college level. But,
when did you pick that up, philosophy?
When I was about 13 years old, actually.
Really?
Yeah. Really? I've you can ask friends from high school and elementary school ever since I guess I this is slightly post hoc. You know, I'm kind of trying, I'm often asked, like, how did I get into philosophy? So I'm kind of trying to kind of come up with the story that accounts for this. And it's kind of built into my DNA.
Really? Wow.
But I know that when I was in middle school, when I was probably 13, I had read, I'd encountered some writings of Voltaire and Rousseau in like a history book. And it was just a paragraph, you know, but it interested me. And, you know, both Voltaire and Rousseau were talking about, you know, human existence in its kind of, you know, pre-civilizational state. You know, back then they would call it the mankind in its primitive form, and that fascinated me.
Yeah, that's interesting stuff.
Kid.
You know,
so I was known for kind of skipping class in high school, but I would skip class for reasons that were unusual. I would go to the used bookstore in my downtown small town and read Nietzsche.
Yeah, wow, that's pretty tough stuff, man.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it is. It's a challenge. I mean, it's a challenging.
I mean, for a 13-year-old, it's pretty heavy stuff, you know. it's existential stuff and, you know, things that a teenager doesn't think about, you know.
Yeah.
So that's impressive, you know. I mean, that's amazing that you had that in your And your DNA, probably.
I'm glad you think it was amazing. I think most people felt it was just strange.
Yeah.
It was odd, you know. But
I think it's cool. You know, I mean, I first encountered philosophy in college, but I fell in love with it. You know, I mean, it was just like, you know, logic and all these things were like, it made sense to me, you know. And I thought, wow, you know, and I started reading that stuff too. And amazing.
It's a great subject. I encourage nowadays, especially at universities, tend to promote programs that are marketable. You know, you better study some discipline that's going to, you know, study a subject matter that's going to, you know,
earn you money,
springboard you into a career of sorts, and things like that. So it's a very kind of careerist, you know,
that's true. So people that study that usually probably go into teaching and stuff.
Yeah,
right?
But I just think philosophy is a great second major. You know, I encourage people to double major in philosophy. Okay, maybe you're doing business or chemistry or I don't know, you know, you name it. You're in entrepreneurship. Even now they have entrepreneurship programs in colleges, and you know, but maybe study philosophy or history or literature as a second major to kind of round out your education.
So what part of philosophy really fascinated you in the beginning? What was it specifically? I mean, I'm very curious about that.
It was really reading Rousseau and Voltaire and the kind of
explain to us what they were talking about.
Well, so for example, there was a debate in Rousseau's time about civilization and the advantages or disadvantages of civilized society and whether this corrupted an innate human spirit or whether it actually kind of molded humans into more civilized creatures. So, you know, are we innately good or are we innately bad? That's kind of a simple version, Hobbes versus, you know, but I think that for whatever reason that interested me, and I was pretty strongly convinced for some reason as a kid that civilization had a kind of corrupting effect on people's innate natures. And so when I was very young, it's a long story, but I wound up when I was 17, I left Minnesota to do this 2 month long solo expedition through a region of Irian Jaya, which is the western portion of the island of New Guinea, to travel among the Osmot, which are a tribe that
seriously
extremely isolated tribe.
You did that at 17. What made you even find out about that place?
Well, that's the thing. I was really interested in indigenous cultures, especially isolated ones. Now what they call lost tribes, but that term, at least as far as I'm aware, wasn't really used frequently then. pardon me.
Okay.
Sorry. I heard rumors of a gentleman who was traveling through Minnesota giving lectures about a particular indigenous peoples who lived on the western portion of the island of New Guinea, mm-hmm. known as the Osmot. And this guy was like, I think he was a Catholic missionary effectively, but because the Indonesian government, which had annexed that portion of the island in the early 1960s, because they felt that this missionary's presence was kind of a pacifying force on an otherwise hostile indigenous group that the Indonesian government under Suharto was more or less colonizing, they let him come and go, even though they blocked off that portion of their territory to outside tourists and travelers and scholars and whatnot. So it remained isolated in part because the Indonesian government felt there might be natural resources there that were valuable, so they didn't want people coming and going. They also didn't want people to report on any human rights abuses that they were engaged in.
Really?
And so but they made a deal with this particular Catholic missionary by the name of Alfonso Sawada, and so I met this guy Al Sawada.
Really?
And I said, you know, how can I go? He said, well, you really can't. But he said, I suppose we could forge some documents and make you appear as if you yourself are a missionary.
Wow.
So we forged documents. We pretended I was a bishop.
Really?
We submitted those to the local authorities, and sure enough, we flew in on it's a very complicated story, but basically, I was left there with a local person who served kind of as my guide, more or less. And I spent 2 months traveling up the Unir River and some of these really remote areas.
How did you communicate with these people? I'm sure they don't speak English, right?
No, they didn't speak English. They didn't even, it was very very difficult. In fact, I had, you know, Osmot is a language that really was only spoken by about 10,000 members of this particular ethnic group. And then by Sawada and a handful of others, It was not a language that was even well studied. So you couldn't get a grammar or anything like that on Osmot. So I had a Indonesian grammar book, but the Osmot generally didn't speak it Indonesian. My guide did speak broken Indonesian, and I had my guidebook, but that wasn't particularly useful. So it was a lot of, quite frankly, we did a lot of miming. And I'm telling you that the limits of, one of the things that I discovered in that process was kind of the limits of human communication and just how kind of incommensurate various conceptual schemas can in fact be different language systems. The way that our language carves up the world. We often assume, for example, that facial expressions are pretty universal because we belong to a kind of a global monoculture that's, you know, call it Instagram or television or Hollywood. But in fact, it was really difficult to read, people's emotional responses and things just off of their facial expressions or their hand gestures and things. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. Your listeners might be interested in knowing this is the region where Michael Rockefeller infamously disappeared in the 1960s. In fact, Al Sawada was the last person to have reported to see Michael Rockefeller. So Michael Rockefeller, one of the heirs of the Rockefeller dynasty, so to speak, was doing some research on a tribe called the Dani, which were better known and more accessible. They lived in the highlands of the island of New Guinea. And at some point after his expedition there ended, he decided to try to travel into Osmot. Mm-hmm. So he traveled down the river into the Osmot region and wound up, encountering Al Sawada, who was the person who I'd met and who brought me there. And then Al, in fact, encouraged him to take his boat because he wanted to continue along the coast. And apparently Michael Rockefeller refused to take his boat. He wanted to use this kind of outrigger canoe that he'd kind of makeshift kind of put together. And they hit rough waters, and those waters are rough. I traveled them. Mm-hmm. And it's a really kind of a shallow, I'm not exactly sure. I don't have the vocabulary to describe it, but it's basically a really shallow ocean where the mud slabs go miles and miles out.
I see.
And so when there's tricky water, when the waters are rough and there's a lot of wind or whatever the case may be, or maybe it has something to do with the tide, the waves can get pretty rough there. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so he tried to swim to shore and disappeared. You couldn't swim to shore there, by the way. I'm absolutely convinced because the water just turns to mud long before you hit the shore.
Wow.
And so I think it's highly unlikely that he did make it to land. But the story is that he was eaten by the cannibals, and that's the story that was printed on all the newspapers, and it launched the largest search in the history of the Pacific Ocean, as far as I'm aware.
Wow, that's interesting.
But yeah, so I traveled and visited those villages where he was supposedly eaten by the cannibals. And it is true that the Osmot do practice cannibalism.
Really?
Wow. And,
so you weren't like a candidate for them? I mean, you're like totally different,
No, I did.
How did they decide who to eat?
Well, their practices were a lot of that had to do with I can't say that you're traveling alone in a place where you're a foreigner is of course always a little bit unsettling in this particular context, particularly so I think. However, I don't think I would have been a candidate for what the Osmot they their staple food source is sago, which is a carbohydrate that's made out of the pulp of a tree. So they chop a tree down and they pound that tree into a kind of mulch, and then they dig a hole anywhere in Osmot where you dig a hole, water will fill it because it's like a swamp effectively. Uh-huh. So they pour water over that pulp and they squeeze the pulp. And it runs into like this gutter system that they make out of the palm tree. And what settles at the bottom is basically this kind of wet, flour, almost a flour substance. They roll that on into a ball and they throw it on a fire and it turns into this kind of almost bread. Mm. Anyways, that's their staple food. They also eat the sago grub, which is the larvae of the Capricorn beetle that also infests these trees. And that's considered a delicacy actually among the Osmot. And they, you know, it's really hard to it's the one kind of food that they don't like to share.
Really?
But
did you have to eat that?
I mean, I was lucky enough to. Yeah. Yeah. on the occasions where I could convince them to share. But these are large. They're like, you know, 2.5-inch, you know, grubs that they eat live. And, they're incredibly sweet and chewy.
Really?
And odd, you know, a little rancid almost, kind of like if you took a bite of a fruit that is like over-ripened, that sort of flavor. But in any case, because the staple is based, their staple food is this sago tree, they have, and those trees, you know, they take a long time to grow. And so there's oftentimes kind of warfare that breaks out between different villages. And the villages are themselves semi-nomadic. So they move from one sago grove to the next to the next. And sometimes with one family unit or one village will move into the territory near a sago grove that another village has claimed. And that's when they have inter-village warfare. And the men who are vanquished in battle are consumed by the victors, basically. And it's actually kind of a ritual way of healing. This is the way that an outsider might describe it. It's like a ritual way of healing the wounds between the rift between the two villages by eating the flesh of the person you've killed in battle. You actually take on their spirit in a certain way, and you wind up, and this is actually sociologically manifest in the fact that you wind up adopting the children of the person of the deceased. So, so it actually, interestingly, it's this kind of ritual that creates a bond between these two villages, and that's. So anyway, so because of that, I don't think I wasn't a candidate for that.
Yeah. So I guess you have to be dead for them to eat you. So
yeah, that's also true. Yeah. You have to be killed in battle. So
yeah. Wow. And so you had to eat all that stuff, huh?
Not the people.
Though, yeah. Not the flesh.
But yes.
But all the other stuff you had to eat, right? I mean, you had to survive. You know, and sometimes I wonder, how did these people end up in these places in the first place, you know? I mean, this is like ancient, right?
Yeah. The Osmot had been there for thousands upon thousands of years. When I entered college, I'd started to study anthropology, kind of get a better sense of, and a lot of my anthropology professors were actually kind of a little jealous, to be honest, because how come you got to go to Osmot?
Yeah.
They were studying like the Sepik River region people in Papua, which is, again, people who were a culture group that exists in a place that's easier to access, more accessible, and better understood, better studied. But there wasn't a lot of research actually done on the Osmot because of Suharto's regime and because they basically clamped down on that region and wouldn't allow people to travel in or out, including anthropologists. But from studying the language now, we know that they entered. I can't remember, you know, I don't want to actually quote dates, but they've been there for thousands of years, for sure.
Yeah, that's amazing. Wow. Yeah.
Fascinating.
I mean, out of all places in the world, that's where you ended up, you know. It's pretty unusual, you know. I mean, you've got some stories to tell, you know. Have you thought of putting it in a book once?
I have extensive journals from that time. You know, you've got a lot of time on your hands when you're traveling in places like that. And so I have, but no, I haven't really. Maybe one day.
Yeah. Maybe even go film something there.
I'm sure it's changed quite a lot. This was the early 90s. This is the first half of the 1990s, 1994. Right.
But how much can change in a place like that? You know, I mean, it's not like they invent computers and stuff, right?
But what happens is that they you know, because there are natural resources, I think logging has been occurring. It's changed because the world has imposed itself upon the Osmot people.
I see.
From the
outside. They come in touch with the outside world?
I believe so, yeah. I mean, yeah. I know that it was, you know, there were even along the coast, there was already evidence of that happening. The Indonesian government had, you know, tried to set up like a military post in a town called Agats, which is where Al Sawada had his missionary post. And yeah, so you could see that it was, you know, that kind of slowly they were kind of the outside world. They couldn't hide, you know, the Osmat couldn't hide from the outside world forever. And
yeah.
So I'm not entirely sure what the situation and the circumstances are like there now, but something tells me that I'd be rather, that it might be a little depressing. I mean, I might be, but maybe, I mean, again, this is a value judgment, and maybe this is my old, you know, 17-year-old self making the value judgment.
Right.
Maybe from the standpoint of many people there, they greet the outside world with open arms, and they're happy to have access to certain, you know, modern comforts. But when I was a young kid, and I think I feel like my mentality slips back into the mentality of this 17-year-old.
Uh-huh.
You know, quite frankly, child that I was at the time,
right.
I kind of valorize and kind of romanticize this kind of
way of life.
Yeah, or? Yeah. This you know, again, like the word that would have been used then is primitive, but of course that's now taken as a pejorative term.
Right.
But what I would mean by it is a society that exists outside of the encumbrances of, you know, modern technology and
things
of that nature. So yeah, but I have to say, I mean, now I'd have to reflect and take a more mature, you know, my perspective on that experience is so shrouded in my own kind of my own worldview at the time that I'd have to really think long and hard about it in order to. But yeah, so I think it has changed a lot. I'm not sure. I have not made plans to travel back. I'm not sure how easy it is to go, to be honest.
Really. It would be harder now?
No, I think it'd be a lot easier. I think it's been open. In fact, I think in the late 90s it was opened up. And that was the other thing that would change. You know, everyone knows that tourist culture changes a place and changes the people.
Right, absolutely.
And so what, you know, the ceremonies that I had witnessed then were, you know, now might become performances, you know. Like you see that in places like, I don't know, Bali famously, right? Where where the performances are in some sense preserved as a form of entertainment for the travelers, you know,
right.
Part of the, you know, kind of built into the tourist economy.
Yeah. Very interesting. So you came back probably a changed person, right? I mean,
I did. I absolutely did. Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't return to high school at that point. I just went directly to college. I had an art teacher who was like, no, Adam, this is an oppressive space for you. So then, went on from there, and I wound up doing my undergraduate degree in South Asian studies. Another place, another culture that I was just fascinated with ever since I was very young. Was India and its various philosophical traditions,
right.
Early Indian Buddhism.
Very rich in culture, obviously.
Incredibly
right?
rich.
A huge place.
Yeah, a very different place, because, you know, the Osmat are kind of, they're a non-literate society. They pass their traditions down orally. Of course, the Rig Vedas, the early Vedas, were also passed down orally in ancient India, but of course, it's a highly literate society, India.
Right.
In fact, there's more classic literature in Sanskrit than Greek and Latin combined.
Really?
So I decided to dedicate my life to studying those traditions and became especially fascinated in a tradition called Kashmir Shaivism and the work of a 12th century Kashmir Shaivite by the name of Abhinavagupta. And so I spent about 5 years studying South Asian studies in the University of Pennsylvania, but kind of going back and forth between India and Philadelphia.
So you were traveling to India at the time too?
Yeah. What happened was I went to college and the one professor, I'll name him, his name was William Melandra. He was a professor at the University of Minnesota, which is where I spent my freshman year of college. He refused to teach Sanskrit. He was the only Sanskritist at the University of Minnesota, and he refused to teach a freshman or an undergraduate Sanskrit. He said, you know, Sanskrit is a complicated language. It's very specialized. You should do something more general, study something more general, and then come back and study Sanskrit. So I told him to take a hike, but I was the one who took a hike. I grabbed my backpack. I flew to India. I lived in Bodh Gaya at the Mahabodhi Society, which is a Theravada Buddhist monastery and guest house for pilgrims for a period of time. And then I wound up enrolling at the Banaras Hindu University in Varanasi, where I studied for a semester. And I lived in Sikkim. I lived all around.
How did you find out about these places?
Oh, boy, that's a good question. There's a really, I don't know how much time we have, but there's a really bizarre story that I guess I'll just tell whatnot.
Yeah.
When I first told my
parents. You're full of stories. I mean, we want to know.
Okay. When I told my mom that I was going to go to India, she's like, well, how are you going to find your way? And I'm like, well, I'm just, going to head over there and figure it out. She said, no. Let me. So she had a friend by the name of Sister Mary Sharon. You can see, by the way, that I grew up in a German Catholic context. So she had a friend, Sister Mary Sharon, who was a nun, who had just come back from a conference. And at that conference, she met one Father Robert Athickle, who was Father Robert was an Indian Catholic. There are a lot of Catholics in certain parts of India, like Kerala. And she said, well, why don't I put your son in touch with Father Robert? And so she said, let me dig around and see if I can get an address for this Father Robert. This was back, before email had reached most parts of the world, Stearns County, let alone India, or where he was based in Patna in Bihar, India. Anyways, and so so finally she finds an address, and I write this Father Robert, and I get, a month later, I get a letter back from Father Robert. Adam, yes, please come visit us. It'll be wonderful. And give my, greetings, send my greetings to Sister Mary Sharon. So I get on a plane. I fly to Patna. I meet this Father Robert. We become good friends. He's the one who introduced me to the religious community at the Mahabodhi Society in Bodh Gaya. Many months later, Father Robert and I are sitting around. I wouldn't see him very often, but I would sometimes pass through Patna while I was living in India. And we were sitting on his porch, basically, and he said, why don't we go say hi to Sister Mary Sharon? I'm like, Sister Mary Sharon? She's here? This nun that, from Minnesota? And he says, nun from Minnesota? He said, well, let's just go say hi. So we walk over, across the kind of, I don't know, down this little path that leads to this nunnery, effectively, and here's this cute little old Indian sister who's named Sister Mary Sharon. What? I'm like, wait, that's not the Sister Mary Sharon that I know.
Yeah.
And it turns out that the Father Robert that Sister Mary Sharon in Minnesota knew isn't that Father Robert. So it was this strange, epic international crossing of wires.
So
the person that I was put in touch with was just a random guy who happened to be a Father Robert in Patna. But it all worked out for the best, because he was a great guy and still to this day remains a friend. So
all the events, to end up where you were, it's amazing.
Yeah, it's pretty silly story to share, but
yeah, no, that's cool. So and how long were you there at that time? How long did you spend there?
I was there for 7 months. On that trip, that was in 1996, and then I realized after a semester at the Banaras Hindu University that it would in order to study Sanskrit seriously, I kind of needed to hunker down at a university and have a slightly different kind of training. In part because, right, I was learning Hindi, broken Hindi here and there, but most of the students at the BHU, as it's called, spoke a modern language that is that's the offspring of Sanskrit, you might say, a descendant of Sanskrit. So it was intrinsically harder for me, having no vocabulary, and I felt like I needed to study in a different context. So I wound up transferring or moving back to the States, going to the University of Pennsylvania, which had at the time by far the strongest and most robust classical Sanskrit program, basically South Asian studies program. They had, everyone from, they had, I think, had six or between six and eight Sanskritists back then. Now, you can't find a university that has more than one, which is real sad, because it's an incredible language with an incredible literature and just vast, vast right, philosophical, historical, literary work.
Amazing. I think in a previous life you were probably South Asian, because you've got all these desires that I don't understand where they came from, but obviously, you know, you got interested in a lot of these things that normally people don't even think about, you know. So
I have to say, I don't even think about it. You're digging deeper than any, I haven't given an interview like this.
All right. Well, we could probably use 3 more hours to find out about you, but we better get to the movie and talk a little bit about that. The film is called Anuja. And what does Anuja mean? Is that a name of a person?
Or? It is. It's a proper name. It does technically mean little sister. Okay. But I don't know if most people who hear the name Anuja think little sister. I think they just, Anuja is just, it's just a proper name.
I see. Okay.
But that's why I selected it, actually, because of its meaning.
Okay. So tell us a little bit about the plot.
So the film follows two sisters who, the younger one is approximately 9, the other, the older is about 16, who work in a back alley garment factory in Delhi. And it basically, you know, it tells the story. It's kind of a slice of life. It's a kind of a coming of age story that follows these two sisters and develops their relationship. And the actual log line is that, you know, when Anuja is suddenly offered an opportunity to study at a boarding school, she's faces a decision that's going to transform. Well, it's going to impact the future of her and her sister.
Yeah.
But you know, it's a story that deals with the problem of child labor. It deals with the relationship between child labor and girls' education,
right?
Which I'm happy to discuss. But it's not a doom and gloom film. It's not just a public service announcement. It's meant to be a coming of age story. It celebrates the resilience and the imagination of these characters, and honestly, also the mischievousness of childhood itself. And when we were researching the film, we felt like it was really important to make to for the final product to be a movie that these kids would want to see themselves. You know? And that also wasn't just true to those circumstances, mm-hmm. and to the harsh realities that these kids live in, but was also true to the kind of underlying spirit that we experienced in these kids.
Yeah. Amazing. Now, I guess the part we skipped over is, how did you get into film? I mean, what made you want to do film? Well, and then you wrote the film probably, right? And directed it. And
that's
everything.
Right. Yeah. I'm the writer and director, and I produced it with my wife, who's a South Asian, she's an artist of South Asian origin, Suchitra Mattai, she's a visual artist. And if you don't know her work, she's accomplished in a
really?
Way that I'm,
oh, wow.
Yeah. So she's fantastic. And you know, if your listeners are if they're connoisseurs of contemporary art, they may know her work. Uh-huh. So we worked on it together. Oh, your question, how did I get into filmmaking? So I'm a professor of philosophy.
Oh, you are?
At a university in Denver.
Uh-huh.
And I've been living out here in LA. We moved out for my wife's career 2 years ago, and I've been teaching mostly remotely. I'm actually on sabbatical now. But
Don't you just teach here? I mean, and then you don't have to do it remotely.
You know, part of it, that's a good question. When we moved out, we weren't entirely certain, you know, what the future held, you know, and I had, kind of deep roots in that institution there, the university there, and commitment to their mission. And I built the Public Humanities Center there that I still direct, partly remotely, but also I fly back a couple times every semester for programming and events.
Right.
It's kind of a film and philosophy center. We deal with other arts and literature and history and politics, but we do a lot with film and philosophy there. You know, to be honest, how I got into filmmaking, I've always been obsessively, you know, I guess I've always just loved film. And, you know, this is going to be common for everybody pretty much who gets into filmmaking, loved film from a very young age.
Right.
You know, biking, I would bike 3 or 4 miles to the local cinema, 10 a.m. to catch the early matinees. Then I would just hop from one auditorium to the next through the day, you know, pay one ticket and see 5 films. But you know, and I've always been friends with filmmakers. I'm not sure exactly if that's a coincidence or if I've sought them out. But at a certain point about 10 years ago, I just started realizing that as students, to be honest, I'm going to be blunt about this, the students were less and less prepared to read the philosophical texts that I was assigning. I was finding film to be a kind of useful tool, a heuristic tool, to kind of get them engaged in the philosophical subject matter. So yeah. I would show a clip, or I would show screen an entire film, and then I would use that film as a way of launching a discussion that was, whether that be on the nature of, you know, the nature of evil, or freedom and determinism, problems of intersubjectivity, ethical issues. I would turn to film, and so I was using film increasingly as part of my pedagogy. Okay. And I started teaching courses in film and philosophy, just straight out.
Yeah.
And so, and at some point, you know, I always knew I wanted to make films.
Right.
That was something that, you know, was just part of just in my DNA, but I kind of thought it would be something I do as the kind of last chapter of my life, you know, in retirement. And then during the pandemic, everything just kind of came into focus. And I just finished a book that I'd been working on for a long time, and an academic book, philosophy, and which is coming out in paperback next week.
Oh, wow. Congratulations.
So, thanks.
What's it called?
The Phenomenology of Revelation in Heidegger, Marianne, and Ricoeur. So it's a wordy title, but basically The Phenomenology of Revelation. Uh-huh. And so I'd finished this kind of long scholarly project, and I thought, you know, I'm gonna start writing a screenplay. We were cooped up, I was teaching from home, you know, remotely, as everyone was.
Right.
I had a little extra time on my hands because, well, we had less committee work, you know, there was just less going on, you know, and I'd already kind of developed the online course I was teaching. So started writing a screenplay. And as soon as the pandemic restrictions were lifted, you know, I had a friend in Denver who knew someone with a cinema camera. And so I shot my first short film with the help of some really fantastic friends in Denver. This was just 2021 maybe. Mm. And Anuj is my second film. So I made a documentary with my son as a school project that we shot zero budget on a phone, which is great. We went out into Hollywood and encountered an unhoused man of indigenous background who happened to be from Minnesota originally, which is where I'm from. Mm-hmm. And we interviewed him and were able to kind of piece together an incredible story about this guy and his background. So that was a doc. That was a short doc that we did,
right,
as like a little side project. But in terms of narrative fiction film, Anuj is my second film.
Well, congratulations. I mean, it sounds amazing. The girls that played in the movie, how did you find them? I mean, are they like actresses where they live, or?
It's a great question. Well, the origin of the story, in part, I mean, our initial reason for making the film, some of it is just inspired by my wife and her family's history. Her family was brought by the British as indentured laborers from Uttar Pradesh, Gorakhpur, a town north of Varanasi, to Guyana in South America.
Really?
And which is a country that's kind of part of the culturally part of the Caribbean,
right,
to work the sugar plantations. So
were they taken as slaves?
They were. Some historians say this is slavery by another name. Mm. They were taken to replace slaves. So the British abolished slavery, they turned to their colonies, especially India, to recruit to basically fill that labor force. And so they went into villages and towns and recruited people. Now, whether the people knew exactly what they were getting into is another question, whether they were duped and the living conditions were terrible. They had no rights. They were told that they would work a certain amount of years and eventually they'd be given land or whatnot. So her family has this kind of history of indentured labor built into her great-grandparents and her grandparents. So we were always interested in questions of labor. And we were developing a coming-of-age story when my wife came across a statistic, which is quite startling, namely that 1 in 10 children globally is engaged in child labor today.
Wow.
And that's not like working in your parents' restaurant or having a paper route. That's like working to survive, working instead of going to school, work that's, you know, detrimental to their health, development, right, well-being, as defined by UNESCO.
Very young children as well.
Yeah, kids. These are kids under under 15. So 1 in 10 kids under 15 is engaged in work. And that's 160 million kids. And yeah, so we thought, wow, there are a lot of coming of age stories that are made every year. We couldn't think of a single one off the top of our heads, at least, that dealt with kids from that background. So we started to do some research, mm-hmm, and with our connections, I knew some people who worked in various nonprofits in and around Delhi. Eventually we were put in touch with a really wonderful organization called the Salaam Balak Trust, which is an NGO or a nonprofit based in Delhi that provides food and shelter and education to street and working kids. And we worked with other nonprofits as well, but the Salaam Balak Trust became a really important partner in helping us research the problem of child labor and in producing the film. Right. When we were casting, we had, you know, we'd solicited self-tapes from actors all over northern India and even from Mumbai, where there's obviously a huge film industry, perhaps the biggest in the world. And we received, you know, well over 100 self-tapes of girls who, you know, we might have cast in the film. Mm-hmm. But we felt that a lot of these self-tapes were coming from kids who came from acting backgrounds with, like, you know, they had, like, resumes and they'd acted in commercials and films and their right, parents were in the industry. And a lot of them were charming and wonderful. But then we thought it would be really good. It would be ideal to cast from the community itself, to cast mm-hmm. someone who has this as part of their life experience. And right, sure enough, the Salaam Balak Trust has they're effectively their orphanage, where their home for children. They have a theater program because this nonprofit was actually founded by the family of Meera Nair, who is a director that some people might recognize the name of. She made Monsoon Wedding, Slum Bombay, a lot of really wonderful films that have gotten distribution and a lot of acclaim globally. Mm-hmm. Her family founded that nonprofit, and because of that connection between the nonprofit and this filmmaker, they have a robust theater program. It's a program that's designed to give those kids the opportunity to express themselves and to develop self-confidence. And so a lot of their kids wanted to be in the film and sent us self-tapes. And when we finally got the one from Sazda Pathan, the girl who plays Anuja, it just was mind-bogglingly good. I mean, it was like you couldn't look away from this performance, mm-hmm. even in the self-tape. You know, she didn't even have the script. You know, she just had this little section of this, you know, this, like, what they call sides. Mm-hmm. And we were just blown away by it. And so we're like, mm-hmm. that's Anuja. It turns out that Sazda herself, her own story parallels, coincidentally, the story of the girl in the film. She was living on the streets mm-hmm. about 8 months before we shot the film with her older sister, just trying to get by. And and so she brought her life experience to the part, and she just brought a kind of authenticity to the role. And you can see it in the film. Like, she's yeah. when we were shooting, there were all kinds of little things that would come out that were clearly she was drawing from her own experience. Like, just real quickly, I have to tell this story. It's my favorite little story to make.
But we are just about out of time. But ahead.
Yes, okay. Well, this is the end story. So we were shooting the scene where Anuja's character is held by basically a security guard, mm-hmm. and in the script it says nothing about doing this. But Sazda on the second take spontaneously bit the arm of the guy who grabs her. So she's grabbed and she bites the arm to get free. And of course, immediately, like, that's exactly the take we're going to use. Like, that's going in the film. Yeah. But it was just a spontaneous thing that she did because, you know, drawing, she's lived through some harsh realities and she yeah. knows how to get out of a tight spot. Wow. And so it comes out in the film.
Wow, that's amazing. I mean, you bring it out to light, you know, a topic that many people don't want to talk about, you know. And or don't know anything about, you know, and that's amazing. Adam Graves, how can people see the movie? Is it available anywhere? Because I know short films sometimes are just in festivals.
Right now, it is just in festivals. We are we're doing some kind of, you know, 4-year consideration screenings in the next mm-hmm. Couple of weeks. One in New York and one in L.A. We're going to be in a couple upcoming festivals. Holly Shorts actually has a London. It's like their inaugural London edition. Uh-huh. Early December, we're at the St. Louis Film Festival, which I think just finished. The Folay Festival in Ireland. But we are going to do, we're kind of talking with some people about distribution, but in the short term, we might be doing a kind of a private, kind of online screening party. I'm not exactly sure how we're going to frame
that
this.
That would be cool. Yeah.
But yeah, so I would say the best thing to do is, you know, try to stay in touch with me and you know, either the website or
And how
Instagram.
Can people reach you actually?
I'm on Instagram at Graves, that's Graves_films. Mm-hmm. That's probably the best. That's the Anuja Instagram handle as well. So we're posting all of our information there. There's also anujathefilm.com. That's a website where you could find contact information, email, and other things.
Great. And follow the film and where it is.
Absolutely.
Listen, I mean, you definitely, in my book, in my eyes, you deserve an Oscar, you know? So I wish you all the best with that. I mean, you know, you're represented by Catherine, who has had a lot of clients, I guess, go to the Oscars, and so you're in good company, you know.
Yeah, she's fantastic,
and you're a fascinating man. I mean, you know, it's not often that I feel we haven't covered everything in an interview, you know. But I mean, you're full of so much interesting stuff, you know, that it's just. It's amazing, you know, and your wife is fortunate to have you, obviously, and you're fortunate to have her. You guys are very culture-filled and very interesting people, you know.
Well, that's very sweet of you to say. And I have to say that the person who deserves this Oscar is Sazda Patan, the actress who plays Anuja.
That
my dream really is to bring her to the Oscars.
Really? Wow, that would be amazing. Yeah. Adam Graves, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Sam. It's
of
a real
course,
pleasure
and
here.
We wish you continued luck in everything you do.
Appreciate
and everybody, thank you all for listening, and we'll see you all tomorrow.
You're listening to Sam in the Morning, only on LA Talk Radio.